thank you very much for the introductions. I'm really happy to talk to you guys about this. And I was born Catholic, raised Catholic, went to the church my whole life. But in the early 90s, I was really affected by this heterodox priest who was wanted to really teach a faith. And the faith was not actually the Catholic faith. But he had us convinced that Catholics were not Christians. They all needed to be saved. And that that the Mass was not a sacrifice. It was just terrible. And so my roommate and I, we were in Atlanta at the time, and we were part of a church, and we're sort of infiltrating the youth group. There's about 70 or 80 of them. And that we convinced the youth group leader that we would have a retreat and help everyone understand what it's like to be a disciple of Jesus. And I thought, this is great. And she goes, yeah, go ahead and do it. So we had this whole routine how we're just going to convert everyone, tell them how bad the Catholic Church was, and that they'll all be just saved by the time we're done. But the one thing she did, though, was she said, you need to read this book before you go into this retreat, because you want to make sure the stuff in the book is what you teach from. And my roommate, who's a very, very smart guy, don't tell him I said this, but we had this thing going, like we were both ACC schools. I went to Virginia, he went to Georgia Tech, and but he said, well, let's look through this, and we'll probably find a couple of nuggets in here. So he started reading to this, and he's going, oh my gosh, Father Charlie was wrong about this. Father Charlie was wrong about that. Oh my gosh, he's really wrong, and the only method these arguments are really bad that we have. And these are much better arguments. He started reading through this. And then he goes, wait a minute. Now they're talking about contraception. I know that the church is completely wrong about contraception. It's just terribly wrong. And he was really mixed up and confused. So he went to talk to our local parish priest, who was a really, really terrific Irish priest. And he came back and goes, wow. He just destroyed all of my arguments in the Father Charlie had. This is really terrible. This is really confusing to me. I'm going to have to really rethink this. And I go, I think I really want to be Catholic. And I go, okay. And so we both started researching it for months and months and months and months. And then before I know it, he was going, I'm getting really concerned about this because I think God might want me to become a priest. And so, there's like all sorts of really what I would consider to be miraculous callings. One, and Reina is my wife, Louisa. At the time, I just met her, and she was a very prayerful woman, and we'd go to Mass every day. We were having this party at my house. One thing about my wife was she always on time to these parties. So we had this big party going on, and I get a phone call, and it's Louisa. And she goes, hey, I'm going to be late. I'm going, okay, got it. And my friend, his name was Scott, was washing the dishes, preparing some dish for everybody. And I'm sitting up. Scott's right there. I'm right here on the phone. And she goes, and tell Scott that I forgot to pick up. I couldn't find the purple roses, but I was supposed to pick them up. I'll get them for him later. And I said, hey, Scott, here's something cryptic. Louisa forgot to get you purple roses. And he was like this. And then he dropped what he was holding. And he went, no! He said, God, if you want me to become a priest, have somebody try to give me purple roses today. And then he did it like six, just amazing. He would challenge God about once a week. God, have somebody say to me, if you want me to become a priest, the Bible verse from the end of John, feed my sheep. And, we had this gentleman who was sort of a homeless guy that another Catholic friend of ours was taking care of. Very smart, Yale graduate, but was very autistic. And he was going around going, hey, Scott, I want to tell you about this book. My friend Scott was trying to get out. Hey, I've got to go with the youth group. I've got to get out. He goes, hey, I'm about to tell you about this. He goes, no. Ron, tell me about this later. I've got to go. And he's walking out the door. Ron goes, it's called Feed My Sheep. And he goes, claps on the floor. This is like one of six or seven things now. But next thing I know, Scott's calling up all these different orders. And about the time that we went on different vocations, I got married, and Scott became a priest. He's preached here at St. Veronica's a couple of times. His name is Father Lawrence Schrodel. And he was very embarrassed that God was calling him to take on the religious name Lawrence, because that's my name. And And I was going, hey, that's for me. He goes, no, God wanted me to have that name. I go, I'm sure he did. But he was great. But it's amazing to see when I walk around with him, because he's part of the Capuchin Friars of Renewal. I don't know if you ever heard of Father Benedict or EWTN, but they're an incredible order up in New York that work with the poorest of the poor. And when you walk around New York with these guys, anywhere with them, it's like you feel you're with you know, Christ himself. It's such an amazing thing. These men are totally devoted to life. And they're the happiest people I've ever met. They own nothing. In fact, like at one point, he was reluctantly showed me for his cell. And he had a little room that was not much wider than this, maybe about this long. He had a little desk in it, and that was it. And then a place where he hung up his extra habit. No bedding, no pillows, nothing. Just sleep on the hardwood floor. And he had his prayer books. That was it. That was the only thing they had in his room. But it's amazing. They're the happiest people you ever met. So I'm going to begin with a prayer. You know, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And God, today we're talking about respect life. And this is the amazing commandment. It links the first three commandments, which is our duties towards you, along with the one that God has sent for us, where mother and father, the life that they give to us, bridges us with the next six commandments. This is the respect life. This is where we respect the ultimate gift that you give us in creation. The creation where we can, where we are called to preserve both spiritual and physical life. This is a tremendous gift, and you have asked us to be stewards of life. And we ask God that you send down your Spirit, and everyone here, including myself, may be blessed by this teaching. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay. Now, you talk about this commandment. It's always, thou shalt not kill. And we once had a student in here who was here at a very unusual fellow, but I
think I know who you're thinking.
Talking about. But at the end of the class, he challenged me, going, well, you talked about a lot of stuff. Not all this was about, you know, killing people. Like, I was trying to think, what should I say? We're not just talking about physical death, but spiritual death as well. In the Garden of Eden, we died spiritually, and this idea of sin, how it destroys us. And so the part of what we're talking about is both spiritual death and physical death. And one of the greatest stories in the Bible is in Genesis, the very first murder. So think about it. You have Adam and Eve. They procreate. First kids. Cain and Abel. Twins, right? Mm-hmm. And well, guess what? One kills the other one. So we start off not doing too well with the kids, right? But this is how it reads in the Bible. This is Genesis chapter 4. And Abel brought, and you know, the way things work was, Cain and Abel were given different tasks. Abel was in charge of taking care of animals, and Cain was in charge of taking care of the crops, various things, wheat and so forth, that they grew. And so they were both making this background as they're making a gift to God of their, you know, of their labors. And Abel brought forth the first of his flock and of their fat portions. And God had regard for Abel's offering. But for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. Talking about spiritual death. Countenance falling. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? Well, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, its desire is for you, but you must master it. So he has this bad feeling towards his brother, this jealousy, this. And God is saying, you need to master this. And then what does Cain do after God says master? I'm thinking God is telling him master it. So Cain says, hey, come on out to the field. And when they get out to the field, Cain rose against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? And then he said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And as you know, God is God, and he already knows the answers to the questions he already asked, right? And so, and then what does he say? Am I my brother's keeper? That's incredible. And the Lord said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth and received your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, you should no longer, it shall no longer yield it to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and wander on the earth. But Cain said, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast cast me this day away from the ground, and from thy face I shall be hidden. And I shall be a fugitive and wanderer of the earth. Whoever finds me can kill me. Then God said, not so. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone who came to him should try to kill him. Then Cain went off from the presence of God and dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Eden. So, I mean, it's interesting. Pope John Paul II commented on this in his great encyclical Evangelium Vitae, which is the Gospel of Life. So God drove Cain out of his presence and sent him into exile from his native land, so that he passed from a life of human kindness to one more akin to the rudeness and existence of a wild beast. God preferred the correction rather than the death of a sinner, did not desire that a homicide should be punished with another homicide, but he sought that he give the chance to redeem himself. So this is, I think, an incredible story, in that Cain was given the chance to save him, to repent. And God had every right to say, dude, you really messed up. But what I think is also interesting is that the sin, this burden, even though God was given the ability for him to seek forgiveness, that he became like an animal. So this idea that how we act and how sin acts in our lives makes us more akin to something, a beast, animal, something evil, as opposed to this great life that God is pointing us towards, when, that Christ came to restore in us. So let's talk about different types of offenses against the fifth commandment. Legitimate defense. So there are reasons that deadly force can be used. One is, like I said, legitimate defense. There's a principle that you, as a person, were given the custody of our bodies, stewardship of our lives, and that if something puts us in danger or someone close to us in danger, we have the right to protect ourselves and then others as well. And so if someone puts your life in danger, or there's a serious reason for there being a threat. For example, someone's coming at you with a knife or a gun. You have to make a decision. I gotta stop. And the idea is, like, if you can stop them with non-lethal force, that's good. But if you have to use lethal force, it's acceptable, as long as the idea is, like, I'm not trying to kill them. I'm trying to protect me or someone else. So the idea of, like, legitimate defense is that you use proportional response, and sometimes that proportional response could be deadly. But you can't use that as a justify to do whatever you want. For instance, if somebody hits your child, and you should try and restrain them, bully does it, but you don't just shoot the little kid that's attacking your kid. That would not be considered proportional response. Intentional homicide. Now we get back to Cain and Abel, and God says, what have you done? It clips in the value of life. Direct or intentional murder of an innocent person is always wrong and cries out to heaven for revenge. Cooperating with murder is wrong. And so it's kind of interesting. There are four sins which cry out to God for vengeance. First of them is death of the innocent. Second is the sin of the sodomites. The third is the cry of the oppressed. And the fourth is injustice against legitimate wage earners. this idea of intentional murder. Now, putting someone's in a situation that creates mortal danger without a grave reason is wrong. So if you're passing by someone who's hanging on the edge of a bridge and is about to fall, you don't help them, that's not good. Or if there's a situation where you can render aid and you don't, that's putting yourself, you're putting yourself in a situation where someone could be in mortal danger and you're not helping them. There is an interesting example of this is something called bystander syndrome, where you refuse to help someone in mortal danger. The example goes back to 1964, March 13th, almost. What about 62 years ago today? In Queens, New York, a 29-year-old bartender named Kitty Guinevere was heading home from her job in New York, and she was traveling across the city, and when she got close to her housing settlement in Queens, she found that somebody had been following her from the bar. And so this guy attacked her, stabbed her, and she was in the alley of her apartment building. To give you a paint example, if you've been to New York or to Queens, they have these huge multi-story apartment buildings. And 62 years ago, they didn't have air conditioning. They were just wide open. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of noise to distract people. But she made a huge fuss. I mean, she was just screamed and hollered. And underneath essentially a whole bunch of different apartment buildings, people had their windows open. And it used to be the idea that if you're really hot, you could sleep out on the terrace. She tried to make her way into the building, but the door was locked. And so she couldn't get in. And she kept screaming and screaming and screaming. And this guy, her assailant, Winston Mosley, went running off because she was making such a racket. Just horrible racket. Well, he came back half an hour, 45 minutes later. He kind of wanted to see the police and all this stuff around there, see what his dirty deed had done. And no one showed up. And there was Kitty still bleeding. And so he attacked, sexually assaulted her, and killed her. And no one ever responded. When the police questioned the next day, a dozen people said they saw the attack or heard her, but they didn't want to get involved. They thought somebody else might do it. Bystander syndrome. Another way, I thought there was an interesting video I saw on YouTube a few years ago where this man had collapsed in the subway in New York, and he was sort of laying on the ground, and there's one of those narrow staircases, and people were walking up and just walking above this guy. And it showed it for a few minutes with just people just going right past him. And then one guy just goes, "Oh my gosh, what's wrong with you?" He picks him up and starts reorienting him and trying to get him out. And then all of a sudden, all the other New Yorkers sort of pitched in and started to help him get out and kind of get him oriented and really took care of him, got him to the doctors and so forth. But it was just sort of like a chain of charity once folks started to engage with the situation and not leave him there to die. Famine is another example of indirect homicide. So if you have the ability to help folks that could be a very serious sin. Unintentional killing is morally imputable unless circumstances brought about the actions or inactions should not have happened. So what that means is unintentional killing. And then you are still driving and you're texting and then boom, you hit something, it's a person. Well, you didn't mean to kill somebody, but you're being really irresponsible when you're going around. So the idea is that you have a duty to not put other people's lives in danger by doing silly things. Or I think it'd be just you have a toddler around and you got a swimming pool, and you go back to you do the laundry, and the toddler's running around the swimming pool. Unintentional, but it can happen. Or driving even aggressively without any just cause. Or you can go back to the It's a Wonderful Life. How many of you saw it? It's a Wonderful Life. Remember George Bailey when he was like 12 years old and he was working in the pharmacy, and then the pharmacist was all upset, and George got slapped around because the pharmacist, his son had just died of the whatever the fever was in at the end of the, what was it, black fever?
Influenza, I think.
Yeah, the influenza around the 1915 or so. Anyway, his son just died, so he's really upset. But he put the wrong prescription to a lady's, you know, pill canister, and he beat up George Bailey because he didn't deliver it. And he said, I couldn't deliver it because it was the wrong pills, it would kill her. And he goes, oh, you saved me. And then it shows, you know, both sides of when George was, when he fixed it, you know, his life went on and became great, but when he was, you know, he was removed by the angel to show him what his life would be like, that guy was a total wreck, became a drunkard, everything fell apart, and that lady obviously died. So unintentional killing is something to be avoided, and it can be really damaging if your inactions brought that about. Now the big one that we talk about today is, next one is abortion. And when you, am I my brother's keeper, first view of freedom, human life must be respected from the conception and have the full rights and protections of every human. Now, since the first century, the church has forbid both abortion and infanticide. Now, if you read the Bible, you'll notice that the word abortion is not in there. Have you ever talked to somebody who was really abortion supporting? Well, you know, I'm a Christian, and the word abortion is not in the Bible. Okay. Well, the reason for that was it really wasn't a problem in Judah at the time, or in Israel. But it was a problem in the Roman world. So when the church made it to Rome, one of the very first documents, and I don't know if you ever have studied that, the Didache. Have you all studied the Didache? Have you ever heard of the Didache?
I have.
Yeah, of course. The Didache is, the full title is the Teachings of the Apostles. So it was essentially the first catechism. It taught what the church actually teaches when it made the Roman world. And so infanticide and abortion were some of the direct teachings that were in the Didache. And the Didache was very close to making the canon of the scriptures, but it couldn't assign direct authorship to someone, to the apostles, the early fathers of the church. So it didn't make it in there. But it was always there. That teaching has always been constantly within Christian circles. And it was just a first century document. And it was lost for centuries and centuries. You know, it was always talked about. And they go, well, where is this? Well, they found it in the Vatican archives. Nope, it does exist. So the church, you can always say the church's constant teaching has been against this. And have you ever saw them? What was it? Braveheart? I think it was Braveheart, where they had, the situation in that movie was in Scotland, and one of the nobles had decided to, taking liberties with one of the ladies who worked in his house, and she thought, oh, he must love me. And then as soon as he impregnates her, he tells her, oh, you need to get rid of this. And she goes, I can't. And he goes, yeah, you need to go to the witch and scratch it out. And that was the term they used. And it was kind of neat because the rest of it, when Liam Neeson's character encounters this girl who was trying to kill herself at that point and stops her, and he said, it's not the baby that needs the killing. Which I thought was a great part of the movie. So you ever see the movie Braveheart? It's fantastic. Is it either Rob Roy or Braveheart? I can't remember which one it is. Is it Rob Roy? Yeah. It's just a really, really terrific movie. But thinking about... the witch scratch it out, the idea that the witchcraft was involved with it. It brings me back to my days in Atlanta when we were doing pro-life ministry. And I was with my friend who became a priest. And he and I would like come up with strategies. Well, we got to meet the folks before the escorts get to them. And so my friend, Scott, went back and he goes, I found out where they all park, all the people working in abortion clinics. And all they had on their bumper stickers like, my other car is a broom, I love my mother and it shows the earth. It was all this witchcraft related bumper stickers associated with them going, it's kind of creepy. Yeah. But the idea of the occult and human sacrifice and what the world is, what was like, I mean, the idea of being like an animal, like something demonic, it comes to mind. Now, the church's teaching on abortion is very clear. Formal cooperation with helping someone getting an abortion is a grave offense. It's like bystander syndrome. When someone asks or is contempting an abortion, the person gives a response, you know, I don't want to get involved, it's their choice, I've never got one myself. What do we do if we idly stand by? It's interesting at work, people will both know my stance on this issue. And I remember one of my colleagues tested me. She was a lady who was probably close to 40. She said, I just want to let you know that I'm pregnant. I wasn't expecting it. Her boyfriend was Muslim, and he had three other wives and wasn't going to marry her.
Oh, man. Wait, really?
Yeah. And she says, I want to get rid of it. And so she said that to me, and she had an audience around her, so she wanted to see how I was going to react. And I just remember what Mother Teresa said. She said, well, I want your baby. Give me your baby. And if you know, Mother Teresa, when she was speaking to Congress, when somebody asked her about abortion, what do we do with the babies? I want a baby. She says, give them all to me. I will take care of them. It's just human life has value. It always has value. That's one of the great teachings of the Catholic Church. Human life has value. Always has value. Now, the church has attached the canonical penalty of excommunication for this crime against human life. It harms the child, the parent, and society as a whole. Electing politicians who bring about laws enacting abortion without proportional reasoning goes against Catholic teaching. Now, what does proportional reasoning mean? So it means that if you have two really bad choices, this guy's pro-abortion, this guy's pro-abortion, but this guy's a lot worse. It's better to vote for this guy than the one that's a lot worse. But we want to, we don't want to cooperate with evil in voting for folks who...
So does that also mean that we should not vote for any candidates that's pro-abortion?
Yeah. We should.
So what do you think about those Catholics that they don't do abortion, but they support other people's right to do abortion?
I wouldn't vote for it. Yeah, but if they're an alternative.
Yeah, but what do you think about those Catholic voters who said that? Because they want to justify their support of pro-abortion candidates. So they said that I won't do abortion, but I support other people's right to do abortion.
Well, no, I'm saying they're not Catholic.
Okay.
And it's very simple. Human life has value. All human life has value. Medical procedures that violate the dignity of the unborn are wrong. Procedures such as prenatal tests for the purpose of eugenics is wrong. And eugenics is the Latin term that means good birth. In other words, there's this idea that if your pregnancy wasn't perfect, or there would be some defect, or it would be a person who have diminished capacity in whatever way you define that, it was okay to get rid of that person. Likewise, the production of embryos for experimentation or the use of children for spare parts is immoral. Now, I thought it kind of a cool movie about that. You ever seen this movie? What's neat about this movie, at the very beginning of the movie, it shows a lady in labor, legs are in the stirrups, she's got all the nurses around her, and she's doing something really bad. She's praying a rosary, and then the OB nurses are going, gosh, what an idiot. She conceived naturally. You don't know what's going to come out, what that baby's going to be like. It's just terrible. So the baby comes out, they immediately give it a blood test, pull up its DNA, and the DNA says, oh, child's going to have a heart defect, it's marked for the rest of their life to be defective. And then you fast forward about 4 years, and she's become enlightened. She's gotten rid of the rosary beads. She's got the signs in her. And I have like 4 video monitors with, it shows 4 fertilized eggs. And I say, these 2 are really good. In fact, this one's even better. And we can enhance it, you know, straighten its teeth, make it a little bit smarter, you know, make it a little bit stronger, faster. You should take that one. She goes, absolutely. I want the perfect genetic child. So the rest of the movie is about 2 brothers. One who's put down for being not genetically perfect, and then the genetically perfect one. And it's a great movie to watch, is to see the you know, what God's plan is versus what man's plan is for life. You think I have 4. Only one got to survive. So manipulation of the genetic code for creating children with certain qualities is immoral. And then also, yeah, for genetic parts, the idea that you were talking about getting tests. You can get tests.
23andMe.
What's that?
23andMe.
Well, not, but also when you're pregnant, to test a child.
Oh, the sex of the child, yeah.
Yeah, there was a really cool story on NPR a few years ago where they pointed out it's been like 50 or 60 years since genetic tests came out for Down syndrome. And in Greenland, everyone is gets that test, and they do here in the U.S. as well.
It's
but Greenland has
tried to control it, right? Isn't the Denmark government trying to control the Greenland people?
Well, Greenland, they have none. They kill every single child that has that. And so NPR, being the great liberal outlet, has decided we're going to commission folks, and we're going to study all the dumb Americans who had children with Down syndrome, and we're going to show how stupid they were and what these children are like. And see, my father's an OBGYN, and I asked my father about children with Down syndrome because, yeah, we call them happy families. Mm-hmm. Because for some reason, they just managed to make families a lot better. So NPR did a study on this, and they go, they came out with their thesis, and then they said, well, it didn't really work out that well. We found that these families were actually more cohesion, no divorce. These kids have an amazing ability to connect with people. Super empathic, these kids. And I'm going, wow. And see, I work as a trust officer, and I work with clients who, some of them have disabilities, and some of them there's a family I have that has 2 children with Down syndrome. And what NPR decided to do was they're going to ambush interview one of my client's children who has Down syndrome in the parking lot of a Harris Teeter in Charlotte while he was working. This guy's name is Brendan. So Brendan is moving the carts in, and you could hear the microphone with him clashing in there. And this NPR reporter goes, Brendan, so-and-so with NPR, I just hear an interview. And Brendan turns around and goes, hello, nice to meet you. And he goes, Brendan, I got a question for you. He goes, okay, what's the question? What would you say to a woman who's pregnant, and she just found out her child has Down syndrome?
Oh, man.
Can you picture this? So Brendan, without missing a beat, goes, well, first of all, I would say, congratulations. And you're really going to enjoy your baby. And I'm going, Brendan, you nailed it. I was so proud of him. But he does that all the time. Now we're getting to some beautiful subjects here. Just really rosy subjects. Euthanasia.
Oh, Canada is doing it.
Well, not just Canada.
Some U.S. states.
Yeah, you go to New York is about to enact it. Ohio. In fact, we're going to read a little story about this. It's deliberate killing anyone who is handicapped, sick, or dying. It is morally unacceptable. Like during World War II, this part of this eugenics issue was the Germans wanted to wipe out anybody who wasn't perfect. Mm-hmm. So they convinced Austria, there's an example I was reading about, to join Germany, because Austria was kind of hurting during the war, and they were running low on supplies, and the Germans came in with food trucks and just great celebrations and feasts all over the place, and they go, this is great. And they go, we're also going to take care of your children. So your children with handicaps, they get a list of them. We're going to send an ambulance by to pick up those kids, and we're going to take the special doctors in Germany who will take care of them and get rid of these, help them with these issues. So they picked up the kids, beautiful ambulances, load them into these trucks, ambulances. But what they didn't know was that these trucks had the exhaust pipe put into that compartment. So the parents came to get this letter back, oh, we're so sorry. We tried to really take care of your kid, but he died on the way to the treatment facility. Just so sorry. They felt that those lives weren't valuable.
That was actually the first time that the Nazis started experimenting with how to do mass killing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They found that that was not efficient enough when they wanted to expand the group of people they wanted to kill. But that was kind of their first attempt at doing that.
Mm. Yep. So what do you think about when people picking spouses, they want a certain type of, hair color, eye color, or some type of look, because they think that being with these people, they will produce better kids?
Well, I mean, you're just being picky about who you want. I mean, like, some women like tall guys, some
short guys. Yeah, that's how I think. What would you think about this? Because you can go very extreme, right?
But, I mean, you can, yeah. But you're not forcing genetic changes on them. But if you're, like, taking the children, you're modifying them, we're only selecting the ones that have those, I think that's
so
a real
change. So natural selection.
Yeah.
Natural selection is okay, but then...
Yeah.
All things in moderation.
Yeah.
you're allowed to have preferences in who you marry, but you're not allowed to genetically engineer the perfect spouse or the perfect child.
Yeah. Yeah,
sorry, there's another question.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
What about sterilization for women? Like, if somebody might want to recommend that the woman don't have a reproductive system.
Sterilizing a woman?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's morally... Well, let me put it this way. It's the church teaches that you're not to modify. You're supposed to regulate births naturally. Now, there are some situations, you have very extreme situations where if you're pregnant, it could put you in harm's way. My sister is what they call a perinatologist, and that's her job. And but she says that there are some women that they have a very high probability that they could die if they get pregnant. And so the idea is for them to abstain from that to the extent that they can. Sterilization is almost completely bad because we're talking about modifying your body. So if you're a healthy person and you modify your body not to, because you don't want to regulate your behavior, that's bad. And the other part is you're not open to life. So I mean, when you're married, you're open to life. And that's, the church teaches, it wants to be open to life. Because right now we're in this culture of death. Mm-hmm. And I grew up, that was maybe of the same vintage, but the world is overpopulated, we're going to run out of food. It was supposed to happen in 1970, and then it didn't happen. It was supposed to be late 80s.
Well, the kids just moving the goalposts.
Every decade, they move it 10 years.
Yeah.
But what do we find out now? The world's population is declining.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you look at China, I mean, when I visited China in the mid-90s, or in 2005, what struck me was we went to a classroom, and there were like 36 kids, preschool kids in there. Very cute kids. They were saying to us and so forth. Like I was going to, there are the 36 kids, six were girls. The rest were all boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going,
all the girls?
I mean, Chinese girls are like, I mean, they're worth millions of bucks.
Yeah.
So I do want to clarify one thing you said. And you did say it correctly, which is that sterilization of a healthy person.
Right.
Is unacceptable. If there is a legitimate medical reason to for a woman to have a hysterectomy, mm-hmm. because of illness, disease, whatever, that's okay, as long as the purpose is not to sterilize. right? The purpose is to solve the medical problem, and the sterilization is a side effect of that.
Yeah, I didn't get to finish my thought.
Just wanted to make sure that was clear to everybody. Right. But the church does not teach that you can't have a hysterectomy if you need one for legitimate medical reasons.
Right. But the idea is not to sterilize yourself.
Right.
And same thing with men, too.
Yeah.
Men should not be getting sterilized either. Discontinuing medical procedures that are burdensome, dangerous, or extraordinarily disproportionate is legitimate. So if somebody is, we were talking about euthanasia, if somebody's dying and you withdraw the medical support, that is not illegitimate. If there's no, that's not going to be beneficial, just delaying death, they can choose not to have that kind of support. So the idea of allowing someone to die to refuse overzealous treatment is acceptable. It allows death to take its course. So you don't have to go to extraordinary means to keep somebody alive.
Can you repeat that, please?
Well, what I'm saying is that if someone is in really bad shape, that you don't need to, they don't need to have extraordinary medical procedures in place to keep them alive. So if somebody's on a respirator, if they're brain dead, or you know their organs are just working, you don't have to have machines in place to keep them. Or if there is if they're taking, I have a situation right now. One of my really really close friends has cancer, and the cancer drugs were just devastating him. He decided, I'm not going to take this anymore. And so can't force them to take those drugs. This is extraordinarily overzealous treatment for him. So he's chosen that, and that's legitimate.
But that should come from the patient, not the hospital, right?
Right. Exactly.
And you need to be making those judgments with a well-formed conscience, right?
Right.
Well, also, too, it can be from the next of kin as well. Mm-hmm.
If the person's unable.
Yeah, if you're familiar with it,
the
advanced
life
medical directive, that puts your instructions down. If you're in that situation, what you want to have happen. See, suicide, I'm getting some really fun topics here. Suicide, everyone is a steward of their own life. That's the basic principle. You don't own your life, God does. He gave it to us as a gift. We're in charge of taking care of ourselves. And we're not free to take our own lives. It used to be suicide was illegal everywhere, against state law. Mm-hmm. The object of the state is to protect the people.
But how are you going to punish people who commit suicide?
Well, you prevent them from committing suicide. You institutionalize them, you call the police, and then you take them to the hospital, you could restrain them, you get them psychological counseling.
Okay, but it's not that if that person committed suicide,
you don't prosecute them.
You can't prosecute them after they're dead.
You could theoretically prosecute them if they survive for attempting it, but I don't know, that might be counterproductive.
Right. Now, the idea is that the state should discourage that kind of activity.
So, what about the death penalty?
Oh, death penalty? Okay.
Yeah.
We'll get with this a little bit later, but. About the death penalty, the church teaches that that society has a right to protect itself, and that when there are individuals who are incredibly dangerous, that society can take steps to protect them. In most societies, you can incarcerate the person and then restrain them in one way or another. The church doesn't want you to kill people because then they don't have a chance to convert and be saved. And there's been many, many stories of people who convert in prison and change. Now, there are certain circumstances where you can't restrain somebody. If there's a place where you don't have a jail, you don't have someplace that you can restrain the person, the only option that you have would be to kill. I mean, the death penalty is not off the table, but the church can't think of a situation at the moment where anywhere in the civilized world where you can't, where you have to have the death penalty.
Because it's a state right now that is trying to put a death penalty for women who have abortions.
Who is?
I don't remember what a state is. They're trying to pass a law that says if women want to have abortion, they will need the death penalty.
Here in the U.S.?
Yes.
I would be very...
Yeah, I haven't heard of that. I know there's some people who would advocate for that.
Can you,
treating it the same as murder.
Actually, in their state right now, being...
I'd like to see that, because the idea, the way they look at it is that the woman who has the abortion is also a victim of manipulation,
mm-hmm.
and so to give her the death penalty for manipulation, it'd be more likely to have the person who manipulated her have the death penalty as opposed to the woman.
Two lawmakers in Tennessee proposed a bill that would classify abortion as a capital crime, but it never passed the legislature.
Yeah,
that,
yeah,
and almost certainly won't. But two legislators did bring it up in Tennessee.
Yeah, the church would be totally against that. And that's like
two wrongs don't make a right.
Right.
Yeah. But I agree with you that would be horrible if that ever came into place.
Yeah, that's not a good Catholic decision.
And the idea of a suicide, it offends our love of neighbor and ourselves, is against the concept of self-love. It breaks family ties, nations, and other organizations that depend on us. Suicide can set an example to others as to how to deal with problems and can lead to contagion of scandals. Example, I had a good friend of mine who's... mother committed suicide, and then shortly afterwards, brother commits suicide. I wanted to read you this. This is back in 2014, and at that point, just about every state said that you could not commit suicide. It was against the law. And here's a little campaign about this to change the laws. It's called Michael Landon and Brittany Maynard. I don't know if you know Michael Landon. Have you ever watched Little House on the Prairie? Michael Landon was and also Bonanza. He was on there as well. Great actor, terrific actor. Very, very popular. Now, Michael Landon was a hugely popular star of Bonanza, Little House on the Prairie, and Highway to Heaven. He died in 91 at age 54. Landon's last act was hailed as his best. He publicly announced his diagnosis with terminal pancreatic cancer. Appeared on The Tonight Show to openly discuss his pending death with Johnny Carson. Also unprecedented back then, he gave several interviews, announced his determination to hang on till the end. He told Life, if I'm going to die, death's going to have to do a lot of fighting to get me. Landon's grit and determination inspired the nation. When he died a few months later, praise for his unshrinking courage led to obituaries, Goodbye Little Joe in People magazine, exemplifying the media's approach. As word of his condition spread, thousands of letters of encouragement and sympathy arrived daily. Scores of friends visited his house and stood vigil at the gates of his ranch. I have X amount of energy, said Landon, and what I have I want to spend with my family. Landon's youngest daughter, Sean, 4, and Jennifer, 7, were emotionally distraught. As longtime friends and business partner Ken McCrae said, but Michael passed his strength on to them. According to colleague John Warren, Landon spent time videotaping his last wishes to his family and friends. His friends and family had solace. It was Landon's extraordinary calm. Flint says of his old friend's last hours, it was like going off a diving board. He knew it was coming, but he was brave to the last. Now, fast forward a few years, attitudes have changed about the disease and death since then, and in my view, not for the better. Indeed, today, many secretly consider Landon a chump for choosing to struggle until his natural death. If that seems harsh, consider the ongoing emotional international swoon of 29-year-old Brittany Maynard, who has announced her plans to commit assisted suicide, legal only in Oregon, where she moved from California after being diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Maynard is subject to a well-planned PR campaign orchestrated by George Soros' funded assisted suicide advocacy group, Compassion and Choice, formerly known as the Hemlock Society. Compassion and Choice press release applauds Maynard's courage to tell her story as she is dying and alert all Americans of the choice of death with dignity, as selfless and heroic. It's one thing for a special interest group, advocacy group, to spin Maynard's story in its ideological direction, to be sure. Maynard is cooperating in that endeavor. But it is odd how eagerly the press has picked up the narrative of courage and heroism. There has been more than 700 assisted suicides in Oregon. None of these, not even the first one, received attention being given to Maynard's intentions. More, it is striking how the reporting about Maynard's decision to die resembles the reporting about Landon's courage 23 years ago. For example, People magazine, which once applauded Landon for fighting to the end, has now mirror opposite takes of Maynard, and even made her a cover story. For the past 25-9 years, Maynard has lived a fearless life, running half marathons, traveling through Southeast Asia for a year, and even climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. So it is no surprise that she is facing death the same way. On Monday, Maynard will launch an online video campaign with nonprofit Compassion and Choices, an end-of-life choice advocacy group to fight for expanding death with dignity. Maynard's suicide, suicide made Maynard an international celebrity. Partly that is because she's a perfect icon. Young, newlywed, tragically dying, and very pretty. And transgressive for wanting to kill herself rather than face the rigors of late-stage brain cancer. But this alone does not explain why she received the kind of high publicity usually reserved for movie stars, rock stars, and presidential candidates. She has been the subject of stories on Time, on Time Magazine, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, USA Today, CNN, PBS, ABC, CBS, and CNN. The list goes on. I mean, you know, you've hit the big time when Rosie O'Donnell lauds you on The View. But what if Maynard followed Landon's path instead? She still is pretty young, newlywed, and tragically dying. But there would be no cover stories in People magazine or applause from Rosie O'Donnell. In fact, we wouldn't even have heard of her. That speaks volumes for the type of culture we live in. Assisted suicide is considered courageous. That equates with death, with dignity. It doesn't imply that people like Landon, who choose to fight the dying of the line, are undignified and perhaps less courageous. Maynard isn't nihilistic. She's just scared. Those using her tragedy for their own purposes, advocacy groups, ratings, internet, etc., can't say the same. The words of Canadian journalist Andrew Coyne keep ricocheting around my brain. A society that believes in nothing can offer no argument even against death. A culture that has lost faith in life cannot comprehend why it should be endured. So that's interesting, because the last guy who quoted was Canadian. I don't know if you're following the assisted suicide in Canada. But if you're ill, elderly, in Canada, rather than seek treatment, you're offered a little pill you can take. Mm-hmm. If you're old or if you're depressed, you're offered assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. It's for the better for society. So this idea of assisted suicide becomes an option, then it gets pushed. And this is where our society is heading, this whole culture of death. That if that human life has no value. If it stops having value, then, or the value is diminished, kill him. Church is completely opposed to it. Yes, Maria?
Also, I think that's encourage weak of character.
What's that?
Like being weak of character,
uh-huh.
Because like you have the easy way, because you don't want to confront your fears,
right?
And reality.
Okay.
So
but,
they just give you the option to just have quick life.
But it's also like changing the culture. So the idea, if you become sick and you have to spend a lot of money, then you should kill them. If you start to become forgetful, golly gee, I want to kill burn. I mean, I have a lot of my colleagues saying this to me now.
They want to kill themselves?
Yeah, see, if I become in a situation where I start to lose my memory or I can't get around. I mean, I had a client who was a smart guy. He was telling me about... I was very young, and he was in his, late 90s. or his 90s. He was telling me what it was like he was with Mr. Firestone. He sold Firestone tires. And he was saying, I was with Firestone and Henry Ford and then I think it was Alexander Graham Bell, but he was telling me about being with all these inventors, all these amazing stories, and he wanted to fish. So he went to Florida, Homosassa, Florida. He had his house there, and he had his boat, and he'd go out every day and he'd fish. Well, his arthritis got so bad in his knees that he couldn't get into his boat anymore. Mm-hmm. So rather than transition to another phase of life, he decided, I can't do this anymore. And he left a note explaining all this stuff. I'm going, oh my gosh. Dude, your stories alone were incredible. Yeah, I mean, all these legendary people that he knew was just amazing. And he still had his faculties.
Yeah.
But he couldn't do all the things that he wanted to do.
And that's the scary thing about who defines, when life is not working, the individual or the society. But I did want to ask a question about years ago in the church, if somebody took their own life, committed suicide, they were not allowed to have a Catholic burial mass. That's changed. And do you know, or maybe Scott knows, how and why that changed?
Yeah. I'll answer the question, then let Scott tell you the truth. what the church basically says is that we don't know what the circumstances are in somebody's head.
When you really die.
They might have a mental capacity, so we don't know what exactly has led to that. The depression, illness has led them to that situation. So we can't say that that they're condemned forever. So the church says it's up to God to figure that out.
So the person can?
Yes.
And I would imagine that brings comfort to the family, too, if they can
get a new one. Right. Or someone under extreme manipulation. And that's why it's so important for all of you in here in terms of the culture of life. Because, we're reading through, if you read through the catechism, you'll see that our laws, how things are set up, how we look at things, how we're reasoning things, that culture has been instilled into our society. But there is something evil trying to change it. So it was that the idea is that life is precious, life is preserved. We don't, suicide is illegal, abortion is illegal, but we have these things trying to change it, make it regular. Like, it's not abortion, it's a woman's choice. Mm-hmm. An unwanted baby. You don't want to have an unwanted baby
here. They call it a fetus.
Yeah, you can't call it a baby.
So they humanize everything so that you feel like that's just an object, not a human life.
Exactly. To get rid of it. So this idea, our culture is changing. And what stops it is the absolute truth. But all of us know that when you get down to it, human life has value. Has value, always have value. You don't kill grandma because she becomes forgetful. She has value. Always has value.
You don't kill baby killer.
Right.
You don't kill baby killer.
You don't kill the baby killer?
No, you don't kill baby Hitler.
Oh, yeah, go back in time and kill Hitler as a baby? The answer is no, because it's an innocent baby at that point. But kind of along the lines of what you were saying, the suicide, the funeral mass for somebody who's committed suicide, that's one of those examples where the church's teaching hasn't changed, but we've developed in our understanding of how to apply that teaching. So the teaching is, and always has been, and remains, that committing suicide is wrong. And if you do it with full knowledge and full consent of the will, you are committing a mortal sin, and you are certainly endangering your soul. The old presumption was that people who were committing suicide were doing it with full knowledge and full consent of the will. And so you can almost assume that they've gone to hell, so we don't give them the Catholic funeral. As we've improved in our understanding of mental illness, we realize that many people who commit suicide are not giving the full consent of their will and are not working with full knowledge. They are suffering an illness that has contributed. There probably are still people who commit suicide and send themselves straight to hell because they are doing it very intentionally, but we shouldn't assume that, and that's what the church has sort of changed, is we're not going to make that assumption anymore because we don't know in each individual case. And we can actually probably assume that most people who commit suicide are suffering some sort of mental illness that perhaps reduces their culpability in terms of sin.
You know, interesting. You know, one of the vets are one of the professions that has the highest suicide rate. They kill their patients. That's a solution for them.
Why do they kill their patients?
What's that? How do vets kill their patients?
Veterinarians.
Oh, the
veterinarians. Yeah.
Oh, I was thinking about you talking about.
You were thinking military vets.
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, I mean, my dog was sick and kept getting called for the vet. Would you like to come over and give them the shot to take them out of the misery? Morbid.
No, I'm thinking these days the doctors usually don't want to kill you. They want you to continue living on the medical bills that they can get.
Well, they do, but the insurance companies don't.
The
insurance companies want to kill you. They pay the doctors. So if they stop paying the doctors and the doctors have to spend money on you not being paid by the insurance, they want you to take the little pill.
Well, and especially like in Canada, you know, places that have adopted death with dignity, where the government runs the healthcare.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it is government policy that determines whether your life is worth keeping around or not.
Yeah.
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 So, is insurance company deny a treatment for a person that can save their life? They also intentionally kill someone.
Well, that's a great argument. I would say yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The people who make the decision could potentially be morally,
especially if it's something that can cure somebody. If it's like an experimental thing that you don't know is going to work and it's cost lots and lots of money, then that's a different situation. But if it's something that can really help them, and they deny it, and it's not something that is doubtful or unscientific, I would say absolutely. That's a great example. What time do we have?
It's 8:37, so you've got 20 minutes, 25
minutes. Okay. I've got so much to cover. This is so much fun. Respect for the souls of others. Scandal. Leading someone else into sin is a scandal. It is a grave offense that often leads to spiritual death. Spiritual death of the person doing it, the person that led it to scandal. When teachers or leaders who are responsible for imparting wisdom don't do it, but instead create scandal, Jesus said, who causes the little ones who believe in him to sin, it would be better for them to have a millstone around their neck and drown in the depth of the sea. So the idea that this culture of death enacts laws that legalize terrible things, immoral things, we elect people to do it. So a lot of things are, let's put these types of drugs or prostitution or whatever type of issues, even like homosexuality, transgenderism, all these things that are being encouraged today in society, lead to spiritual death, deceives people. I thought this was interesting. This is from 14 years ago. I was visiting my niece in Connecticut at her school, and here's your resource guide for middle schoolers, if you want to become gay. It's literally hundreds of phone numbers, places to call, all these people who can help you become gay. They're pushing this on kids.
Yeah.
They had a great article in California where one of these teachers blew the whistle about how at the major teachers conference how to recruit kids to join the gay clubs. But you don't tell the parents. You look at kids, especially the ones that are autistic or a little bit different or awkwardly social, to tell that they're special, and there's a special club after school we want you to come to, invite you to do it. It's just, it's grooming. I mean, I have a relative of my wife, he was in Massachusetts, and it was interesting. This kid grew up, he's normal, he was taking ED medicine, so he was a little bit short, very artistic, smart kid. I knew when he was freshman sophomore, he was crazy about girls. I knew that was obvious. But by the time he was a senior, he was changing. He started growing long hair, wearing earrings, makeup, long fingernails, etc. Going, this is weird. We found out that the librarian had been talking to him about how special he was, and he wasn't like everybody else. Mm-hmm. So it starts changing. And then you find out there was a national lawsuit where parents were saying that the same librarian was convincing their child that they were the wrong gender. Mm-hmm. And didn't tell the parents. And the parents said, if anything like this starts to happen, we have to be done. And he gave official notice to the school. Still good. They're suing right now. But there's this idea that schools are grooming. We're talking about the culture of death. Mm-hmm. This is what we have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen folks say that you shouldn't put kids in some government schools. I would say that might be really good guidance. I see it with my, I look at my, I'll use myself as an example. My kids are all homeschooled. Mm-hmm. And my brothers and sisters' kids were not. And it's just, there's a total difference in those kids. Very, very different. And my kids, I mean, they had such a great Catholic education, thanks to my wife and the schools they went to. But they know this book. They pray. It's really fantastic. My daughter is in very secular college, but the Catholic group there is so fantastic. It's just incredible what those kids are like. Respect for health. Health is a gift from God and restored to our body, which take reasonable care of our bodies and others' people's needs. The society, not just the government, should help in creating conditions where people can grow and reach maturity. Society should help with food, clothing, healthcare, education, social assistance, and employment. In the Industrial Revolution, before the Industrial Revolution, feudal society, the church was essentially all of the world, all the known world, the Western world. And if you look at feast days and look at the calendar, how they work, the church used to control how people's lives were treated. They would have no work on Sundays. It would control when you went to war, because people had to be back to be able to plant farms to feed their families. And then they would have certain days where they would just have a holiday. They'd have the Feast of St. Joseph. They'd have St. Patrick's Day. And the societies had give people off those days and take care of them. The church also set rules for conflicts and so forth. So the church has always had this idea that we want to take care of people and protect their works. I'm running out of time, but there's a great story. It's about this this fellow by the name of Dagger John. And so it's interesting. Dagger John was a Irish guy. But he wasn't Catholic. He came to the U.S. from Northern Ireland. But when he got here, he decided to convert. His name was John Joseph Hughes. And he's probably one of the most important men in America that you've never heard of. He was first bishop of New York. And at the time, in the 1840s, there was a massive famine in Ireland. And I can get into it, the reasons for the famine, but many, many Irish came to America. And there was Ireland went from a country of 5 million to 1 million. Many of those immigrants came to the U.S. And many just went to New York. And they went to New York and they just piled into parts of the city. And they were just slumlords. There's slums, tremendous slums. I mean, you would have, I think it was rare to make it to the age of 40 if you're Irish in New York. There was lots of drinking, prostitution, abuse of all different types. And the place was just, here's a quote. Family life had disintegrated in a wave of immorality that included the proliferation of rampant gangs known for alcoholism, prostitution, robberies, and mob violence. Over half the people in New York were Irish. Those police vans were dubbed paddy wagons, or the number of Catholics or guys named Patrick that were in them. The mob violence in the streets were called Donnybrooks, after a town in Ireland. So death was everywhere, in 1854, one out of 17 people in the 6th District Ward died in 1 year. In Sweeney's Shambles, the rate was one out of five every 22 months was dead. Life expectancy for among the Irish was 3%. Life expectancy for New Yorkers, Irish was under 40. Tuberculosis was rampant. Bishop Dagger Hughes called the natural death of the Irish immigrants was the leading cause. The natural death of Irish immigrants was not the leading cause of death, but was drinking and violence. So what did he decide to do? He decided to take the principles of the church and put it into New York. He formed the Catholic schools. He formed Fordham University, Manhattan University, Mount St. Vincent College. He personally transformed the entire educational establishment in New York for Catholics. So it went from, it was like miraculous, going from this violent, horrible, to this well-ordered, disciplined society, with all their kids going to school, getting educated, and then learning the values of the culture of life, as opposed to being stuck in the culture of death. And it says the success was stunning. Alcoholism and drug use dropped. Irish neighborhoods were once known for their violence became bastions of peacefulness. Membership in the church rose dramatically in just a short time. The city had been performed, not by fiat, fire, or brimstone, but by deliberate and disciplined efforts of a man whose main goal was to change the culture by transforming hearts and minds in the name of Jesus Christ. Here was Bishop Hughes' secret. He didn't simply preach at them. He talked with them, like a father to a son. And the effects of this direct and gracious approach are still felt today. Experts have suggested that Bishop Hugh failed in his attempt to reform the Catholic culture in New York. The future of... Oh, sorry. There's an if in there. If Bishop Hughes had failed to reform the Catholic Church in New York, the future of American immigration and Miss America itself would have been dramatically altered. So the idea of... Yeah, that's why it's so important that you guys are becoming Catholic, that to take this and be like Bishop Hughes, and his first name was John, and they call him Dagger John because it would be, he always put a little cross before his name, and then John, so he just became known as Dagger John, Bishop Dagger John. And so I look at him as, you know, you guys becoming those Dagger Johns and bringing this amazing truth of the Catholic Church. Like one of my friends challenged me, who's an atheist, he goes, well, what does the Catholic Church mean? We talk quite a bit about it. He said, family, reforming the family, fixing the family, getting rid of the things that cause the culture of death, you know, abortion, divorce, all these transsexual stuff, homosexuality, euthanasia, all things we talked about. The Catholic Church is against that, always has been against it. He goes, okay, well, that makes sense to me. I kind of understand it, but you know, why doesn't the Catholic Church get that message out? Well, yeah, he goes, well, I think the Catholic Church has a marketing problem. I can agree with that. And he goes, well, the other thing I said is, you know, it's been around for thousands of years, 2,000 years. He goes, it's a good point. And the reason is because it tells the truth.
And people don't like to hear the truth.
Well, actually, they do.
You think so?
They tell you, but they don't. I guess I'll tell you another story. I had a friend of mine who was formerly Catholic, married, got divorced, and he married a woman and who was Catholic, and then he finds out on their honeymoon, she goes, oh, by the way, I just want to let you know that, you know, 2 weeks ago, I had a fling with my old boyfriend, just so that, because it was the last opportunity I was getting married, don't worry, I'll be faithful from now on. Well, that didn't work out. And he goes, and he remarried a woman who wasn't a Christian. And he goes, you know, I'm trying to get my kids educated in the Catholic Church, but I can't really get into it because they're in an Episcopal Church. I hate what's going on with the Episcopal Church right now.
I hate that too.
And I said, dude, why don't you see about getting your marriage regularized? He goes, well, I can't. I got married in the church. I go, let me ask you a couple of questions. Did you, were you guys planning on having kids? Oh, no, no, she was, we definitely weren't going to have kids. She was on the pill. I go, dude, you didn't have a valid marriage. And he goes, oh, you're just so righteous. You're terrible. This is terrible. It's awful. And then about, he said, I don't want to talk to you anymore. And then he came back about 2 years later. And, you know, we've been talking. He was a colleague of mine. I see him all the time. He said, okay, is that what I need to say? He said, well, you know, I just wanted to let you know, I did go talk to a priest, and I did get my marriage regularized with my wife, and I'm sending my daughters to Catholic school now, and back in the church. I'm going, oh, really?
What did you talk to him through all these 2 years?
Well, I just decided that I wasn't going to talk to him about this anymore.
Oh, okay.
Because I told him what needed to be said, and then I just walked.
And you leave it there.
Yeah. Okay. And he did it. I mean, it was just, I had to say what I had to say. I mean, maybe I'm giving God the credit. The Holy Spirit said to say it. But, I mean, I think you have to say the truth and not be offended by saying it. It's the truth.
Yep.
We see that a lot. Respect for health. Oh, here, this is great. It's stuff here. Avoid the cult of the body. Avoiding the cult of the body. What is that? That's worshiping the body. It's a neo-pagan practice that emphasizes physical perfection and success at sports. It emphasizes perfection of the body and the strong, leading to perversion of human relationships. Now, this is not like the obligation we have to take care of our body and keep it in good order. We are absolutely obligated, but it's this idea of worshiping the human physique and perfection. The movie Million Dollar Baby, you ever see that one with Clint Eastwood? It's about this female boxer who's a phenom. She's not very big, but she's a phenom. And Clint Eastwood, who's Catholic, produces the movie. Oh, this is going to be great. Because part of the plot is that the woman gets into an unjust fight, and then she's with this really big, dirty fighter who punches her, breaks her neck. And so she's lost her ability to be a boxer. She's essentially paralyzed. And so, like, her best friend is Clint Eastwood, her trainer, keeps coming to see her. But the gist of the movie is that Clint has to make the wrong decision because she doesn't have a perfect body anymore. Mm-hmm. Her life no longer has value in her eyes, so he has to help kill her.
Oh.
It's the idea of perfection of the body.
Plastic surgery?
Plastic surgery? Depends. Yeah. No, but we'll talk about that. It's plastic surgery. Let's see what it says in here. Extreme sorts of plastic surgery obviously can be bad. I mean, plastic surgery to correct things that are broken.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not all bad or to repair things. I mean, my brother-in-law was a cranial facial surgeon, and he told me, like, so what did you do today? He goes, oh, I took a tumor the size of a fist out of a 12-year-old boy's face, and I go, oh. Was there anything left of his face? He goes, oh, yeah, I rebuilt it. Put it back together again. It looks pretty good.
And I'm going,
oh, that's pretty cool. Cool stuff. But, yeah, this is the idea of, like, you pagan worship, like, make your body look different. I had a client who actually died of plastic surgery. And, she had probably 20 or 30 plastic surgeries. And the last one...
I think people get addicted to it.
They do. They do.
Yeah.
But this is the idea of worshiping your body, the looks. But, you know, all things in temperance, like the other things that respect for health is, abuse of alcohol, food, gambling, medication can do tremendous harms to us. We have to be careful about that. And then the use of drugs for non-therapeutic reasons also causes great harms. And illegal drug trade, obviously, is a scandal as well. One of the things you mentioned earlier was sex change operations or sterilization.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously an abuse of plastic surgery. And then we're going to get into now a respect for the human person and scientific research. Scientific study of the human body can be great benefit represents man's domination over nature and advances in healthcare. And if you think about it, the university systems throughout the world were developed by the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
The scientific method came from the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Biology, great, like Mendelssohn, Catholic Church, Catholic guy. Copernicus, Catholic guy. If you even go to, Galileo. You know how Galileo, the church is always persecuting Galileo? Yeah, I mean, there's a whole story I can go into about it, but you know where Galileo is buried? At the Duomo Cathedral in
Florence.
Yeah. He was such a terrible Catholic. I mean, he ended up in the cathedral, right? Yeah, which is kind of cool. The Big Bang Theory, creation of the universe, Catholic priest, Father Lemaitre, George Lemaitre, Belgian guy. So, I mean, the church has got the idea of in science. Was that there's kind of two branches, big branches in the universe, theology, philosophy, and then science. And science is a study of the natural world, how God works in the natural world. And so the Catholic Church is really, really into science. And it's also searching for the truth. What is the truth? That's one of the things that the church is so into. What is the church? We need to understand what the truth is. And that is great, the thing that the church does. But scientific research can lead to experimentation that can be beneficial and can also not be beneficial. You know, one of the tremendous studies in scientific research on humans was done by both the Nazis and the Germans. Nazi Germans and also the Japanese. And there's was looking at this Filipino guy reading his story. He was he was forced by the Japanese to experiment on prisoners of war. And they wanted to see things like how long could they live without organs, certain organs, how long could they live without skin. My father was telling me how the Germans had researched on Jewish women. They'd impregnate them. And then they wanted to see what happened if you didn't feed the women. What would happen to the children?
Yeah.
And they found out that the children were affected, but not by much. Because the mother's body would sacrifice itself to feed the child.
Yeah.
All the stuff you provide from the bones and everything would be just depleted from the mother's body. You know, the mother's body would feed the child. It's an amazing relationship, you know, women with children. It's miraculous. In a lot of ways. You know, my father being an OBGYN was telling me about, I said, Dad, did you know that when when a child is born, or if the baby dies either naturally or through abortion, the last thing the baby does is shoot mama with stem cells.
Yeah.
The baby's stem cells. So every woman who's had a child has stem cells of that child living in the woman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing. I was thinking of the Virgin Mary. She had Jesus' cells living in her.
Mm-hmm.
I think, oh my gosh, my mom is at five. Oh, I said, poor mom. I'm in there somewhere. But it's another miracle, I think. But these experiments had great scientific value, but it was totally immoral. But, organ and tissue transplants. The transplant of organs can be greatly beneficial and represents a sacrifice of one person to help another. Certain issues should be considered, like, was the person dead when you took the organ out of them? Or was the person a willing participant? Or was he killed or accidentally accelerated in order to make this donation? Idea of save your babies are children that are produced in order to have spare parts for another child who's has problems. Respect for bodily integration. Kidnapping, terrorism are immoral. Mutilation, amputation, sterilization of the innocent is immoral except for therapeutic reasons. There's this idea of bodily integrity identification disorder. This is an idea where, it sounds far-fetched, where people, perfectly normal, healthy, physically healthy, have this image that their body isn't correct. Like, their body shouldn't have two legs, or the body shouldn't have an arm, or shouldn't have an eye, shouldn't have a nose, and that people are such extent that they'll want to have their limbs amputated because they think they should be in a wheelchair. They say they should just not have an extra limb. And so it was interesting, I was reading about doctors in England, of course, they're such great doctors. They were saying, well, gosh, you know, if we don't amputate it for them, then they'll just do something to hurt themselves. I'm going, wow, this is a mental disorder.
Yeah.
It needs to be treated like a mental disorder. Mm-hmm. But society, you know, how we have this culture of death, is trying to normalize this stuff. It's the same thing with, like, it being transgender.
Yeah.
Cut everything off, put things in, that's how they think it should look. It's, it's horrible. Respect for the dead. The dying should be treated with respect and dignity and prepare for death with the proper sacraments and prayers. The body of the dead should be treated with respect. The burial of the dead is considered a corporal work of mercy. It honors the children of God who are temples of the Holy Spirit. Autopsies are considered legitimate for scientific or legal inquest, and the church does permit cremation as long as it's not a sign of disbelief in bodily resurrection. Now, that said, up to 1962, you couldn't get cremated. But it does say in the canon law, canon 1176, number 3, the church recommends the pious custom of burial be retained for the faithful. So the church would rather you have your bodily remains than you just being put into it. But the other thing is, like, the body remains have to be treated with dignity. One of our former parishioners here, Ann Bell, was a really interesting lady. Did you know Ann? Yeah, you knew Ann. She was a character. She used to drive around in this car, and it probably had, like, you know, everything she collected for, like, 6 years in that car. And she could barely see with all the stuff that was in there. And Ann was formerly, a stewardess, and she was walking into the Giant one day on a... many years ago and slipped and damaged her hips, and she couldn't really, never recovered from that. So she had trouble getting around. Well, Anne was in the church. She had the combinations, you know, really late at night. She was always praying for the Blessed Sacrament, just a wonderful lady. And Anne passed away. And her family came up, and she was cremated. We had were you there for a funeral? Yeah. But we had a really nice funeral. We had a service here for her. And then her family left. And so one of the parishioners said, hey, when's her ashes going to be, you know, interred? And so they called her family. And the family wasn't particularly Catholic. And they said, well, Anne really liked, you know, the Interstate 95. And we thought we would just drive down there and because we really, you know, even though she left some level of inheritance, they didn't want to spend it on her funeral. So what we did was, you know, the number of parishioners got together and said, well, let's bring her remains back here, and we're going to have a funeral for her. And then, it's in Milkville, the nuns that are out there, they run a ministry for folks who are in that situation. Where they've got those places where you put the ashes, I've got them called
columbariums.
But they have one they had there, and they got one for Anne, but they have some of the nuns there, their vocation is to pray in front of each one of the people that are buried there and in the columbariums every day, pray for that person's soul. I'm going, wow, this is so fantastic. So, but respect for the dead. And Anne was going to have her ashes on 95. I think it was 95. That's what the story was. But it was something just dumped out somewhere, as opposed to actually having a real funeral. I mean, we had so many people in the church come to her columbarium ceremony. It was great. But respect for the dead. We have to have respect for the dead. This idea of, like, grandma up on the shelf. I mean, I had an estate once where we had, there was an urn in the estate. And I'm going, oh my gosh. It was a Now, it was my lady who was working with me on it was Catholic, and she took it upon herself, looked at it. There was actually a number on the urn and she researched it and found out exactly who it was. And then she arranged for the burial.
Or for the
yeah, for the burial of the urn. And so, being respected is so important. These are, we're all temples of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah,
you're a little over.
Okay. All right. Just to guarding peace is the last part of it. One of the aspects of promoting peace is avoiding war. And so this idea that we want to avoid war at all costs because war is absolutely horrendous and leads to lots of different evils within the war. And people are killed for different reasons. So the idea the church is teaching avoid war at all costs. But if you have to go to war, if you're going to have to defend yourself, what are the criteria for war? This is what we call the just war criteria. It's from the Catholic Church. Number one, damage inflicted by, this is the reason for legitimate defense in situation of war. Damage inflicted by the aggressor nation must be lasting, grave, and certain. All means of resolving the injustice must be shown to be practical or effective. There must be serious prospects of success. The use of deadly force must not produce evils or disorders disproportionate to the evil already inflicted. National authorities have responsibility to make sure the use of force is for the common good. Nations have the right to impose obligations on citizens to serve the national defense and allow for conscientious objectors. Soldiers have an obligation to follow moral orders and not conform with illicit evils such as genocide, direct killing of civilians, and non-combatant. Accumulation of arms does not justify maintaining peace through a balance of terror. So the positive laws of Jesus Christ. Jesus came that we might have life into the fullest. What is different now? Well, let's just end this with prayer. And Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and God, we thank you for this, for you being with us today in the study of the fifth commandment. We ask that you bless us and guide us, that we may create a culture of life, the life and truth which comes from your teachings through Jesus Christ, through our church. We ask, Lord, that you protect the attacks on the family, namely your abortion, which is destroying the path of the child-parent relationship, euthanasia, which is attacking the elderly and kindred, and the killing of children and parents, homosexual marriage, transgenderism, contraception, divorce, which is attacking the marriage bond. Lord, we ask that you give us the grace to proclaim your word, to proclaim your truth, that we may transform society into a just and great society worthy of your truth. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thanks very much. As you can see on the board, we need the confirmation of St. James. I know I've talked to a handful of you about that. Please just get those to me as soon as you can. And then, of course, we have our second scrutiny coming up on Sunday. So have a great night. Have a great week.
You guys are great. Wow.